Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. Things seem so dire right now. In Flint, Michigan, a massive cover-up by the office of former Governor Rick Snyder to shield officials from culpability in the now infamous and deadly toxic water crisis has been exposed. Across the U.S., millions continue to be threatened by evictions despite a temporary moratorium. And unemployment benefits put in place during the pandemic are set to expire soon, which could plunge millions into poverty. These are just some of the ways that shockingly high levels of inequality and corruption are plaguing the supposedly richest country in the world. Yet, it's never been more difficult to be in left media covering these issues as censorship and underhanded algorithms suppress content that challenges the corporate media line, and where, sadly, the left media ecosystem has descended into a bickering match between personalities. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party remains firmly in the hands of its corporate funders, who recently spent millions to sink the campaign of former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner, precisely the sort of person we need to take on the multiple crises of capitalism rotting the country and the world. To discuss these issues, I'm joined by Jordan Cheriton, journalist and founder of Status Quo, which has been one of the only outlets covering issues like Flint and the eviction crisis around the country, as it also deals with blatant suppression on social media platforms like YouTube. Jordan was also covering Nina Turner's campaign on the ground. Jordan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. And by the way, just so credit where credit is due, my partner, Jen, was also on the ground with me in Cleveland, covering Nina's race, and then Flint too. So I want to make sure she's getting credit too.
Absolutely. Jen, you and Jen have both been incredible. And, you know, you've really been some of the only people on the ground covering a lot of issues that the media really isn't paying attention to. And sadly, even left media isn't really investing in covering. So there's so much to talk about here. I guess let's start with one of the bigger issues that you've been following. Again, one of the only outlets following this issue is the cover-up that you and Jen helped expose in Flint, Michigan. Can you briefly explain to our listeners and viewers what happened in Flint and what you discovered about the role of the governor's office?
Yeah, so this is kind of our fourth major story in 2 years that has been swept under the rug. So basically, in a nutshell, Flint was a privatization scheme. They were trying to privatize the water system under the guise of a brand new public water utility. That was nonsense. And while they were building this brand new water pipeline in 2014, so a while ago, that Flint was going to join, Flint was temporarily put on the Flint River. If you lived in Flint, I mean, the Flint River was General Motors dumped its waste in there for 100 years. Other industrial corporations dumped their waste. It was a cesspool. So, you know, they just coincidentally, the state environmental department, Snyder's administration, forgot to put in the proper chemicals to make sure lead in the 75-year-old to 100-year-old pipes did not leach off. I mean, America's infrastructure underneath us is 50 to 100 years old, lead pipes, galvanized pipes, cast iron pipes, which if you don't add the proper corrosion control chemicals to the water when you're treating it, it's basically like acid water coming in and lead will leach off and other things will happen like bacteria will develop. And that's what happened in Flint. Toxic lead levels, Legionnaire's disease, which is a waterborne bacteria that kind of mirrors pneumonia, but is much worse than pneumonia. So a lot of people died and people are slowly dying. I've actually been there to Flint 18 times since 2016. Jen, I think, is close to 10. And each time we go back, it's not just the people that have died. It's the people slowly dying because heavy metal poisoning progressively gets worse over the years. So what we discovered, first we discovered years ago that Governor Snyder's environmental department was cheating on the water testing. So they Snyder used this water testing to declare the water safe again and basically to move on. But they were sending officials into residents' homes to literally run their water right before collecting the test, which is against federal regulations because it flushes out lead and you get falsified numbers. Then last year, we broke that the governor's right-hand man, like top advisor. So think like, I don't know, Trump's Roger Stone, like his fixer. He was going around Flint offering sick residents payoffs, because especially residents that were getting media attention and ranting and raving at town halls. They were going around offering residents like special treatment or pilot programs where the state would pay for their medical treatment or the state would expand their Medicaid just for them, nobody else. And if the treatment worked for them, they would offer it to other Flint residents. One couple told us that Snyder's henchman, Richard Baird, actually told them, oh, I'm going to go tell the governor about this. So that was last year in Vice. There were other details in that story, including how a basically financial fraud led to Flint being on the Flint River through a water privatization scheme. Then in January of this year, unfortunate timing, because Trump got impeached for a second time on the day we published it, we obtained Governor Snyder's phone calls, the governor, his chief of staff's phone calls, his health director's phone calls, as well as documents from the criminal investigation. So they were all on the phone rapid fire in October 2014, over 2 days, 22 phone calls between the three. Why that's important, October 2014 is when Snyder's health department and environmental department were communicating back and forth about this deadly Legionnaire's disease. Just happened to be a couple of weeks before Snyder was up for re-election. So the prosecutors concluded they were on the phone covering up the Legionnaire's disease. So Flint residents wouldn't know about it. The rest of the country wouldn't know about it before Snyder's reelection. Then Snyder told Congress, I didn't know about this till 16 months later. Well, our reporting and what the prosecution found, prosecutors found, was he lied, perjured himself, and he knew about it in October 2014, while there was still a chance to save lives if they would have notified Flint residents, stop drinking your water. Fast forward 2 weeks ago, Jen and I broke. We discovered that Snyder's top officials, his press secretary, their phones were mysteriously erased right before the launch of the Flint criminal investigation. Other officials, top officials in the state health department, when prosecutors got their phones, like a fart in the wind, no messages, no messages from 2014.
How convenient.
All the way through October 2015. And that period was when Flint used the Flint River. Environmental department officials allegedly dropped their phones off to the state IT department, quote, wiped clean shortly after the governor held a press conference acknowledging Flint's water was toxic. So all of a sudden their phones are dumped off, erased. And finally, the governor himself refused to hand over essentially everything to prosecutors for 3 years. It was this behind the scenes legal war. He wouldn't hand over his daily briefings, which he got in a packet from all his departments. He wouldn't hand over conference call notes, just a lot of things. And this is, you can't find out who knew what when if you don't have access to what he was being briefed about. So that story 2 weeks ago, co-published in The Intercept and the Detroit Metro Times, there was a lot of other things, including his same right-hand man who paid off sick residents, was approaching state officials before their interviews with criminal prosecutors, trying to get them basically on script not to disclose certain things. So here you got destruction of evidence, hiding of evidence, tampering of evidence, and Snyder potentially obstructing justice.
And so where's the accountability here? I mean, you have been really, you confronted a couple of local media outlets, which have shockingly in Michigan not been covering this. And furthermore, you know, Snyder's not in power anymore. You actually have a Democrat in power. So just by sheer partisanship, I'm surprised this isn't being used by Democrats against their, you know, against Republicans. Like, why is everyone ignoring this? And before you answer that, I want to tell people, because I don't think this is, you know, this should go without saying, is that it's not just Flint. What happened in Flint sounds incredibly criminal, but a Reuters investigation in 2017 found that in all, 3,810 neighborhood areas in the U.S. recently recorded childhood lead poisoning rates at least double those found across Flint, Michigan, during the peak of that city's water contamination crisis in 2014 and 2015. And then some 1,300 of these hotspots had a rate of elevated blood test at least 4 times higher than Flint's. So I guess I'm curious, why is this being ignored? And is it because maybe Flint isn't the only place that this is happening?
A few things. So first off, this is not at all to challenge you, but I've said this for years. That Reuters story is very misleading, because this is what other people use to kind of, I don't want to say minimize Flint, but kind of make it seem like there's worse than Flint. We proved they cheated on the water testing. I mean, Aaron Brockovich came out and basically said, this is a crime. Their testing should be tossed out and it should be redone. Governor Whitmer, acknowledged that they tested the wrong way. I mean, it was deliberate to falsify the numbers. So in reality, media has declared, oh, the numbers are good. Flint's water is safe, meeting EPA regulations. All you got to do is go to Flint for an hour, speak with residents, go in their homes. The water cannot be declared safe. The second thing is, to tell you the truth, Rania, I don't think anybody really knows the real lead levels in Flint to then compare it to other cities, because the 2-year testing that they did, 2016 through 2018, we found dozens of homes and residents that they were running the water or telling the residents to run the water. That was from knocking on nearly 500 doors. So imagine if we knocked on the whole city. So it's not to say there are not high lead levels in other cities. Absolutely. I've covered not just lead, by the way. You're talking about PFAS, which is a cancer-causing chemical. You're talking about chromium, aluminum, a lot of different things. But I think people, Reuters, like many national outlets, just kind of took the state of Michigan's words for it, what the numbers are, and then compared it to other cities. So that's
so you're saying Michigan's likely a lot worse.
Yes. Yes, because I can tell you, to be clear, number one, I've been in residents' homes, not 6 years ago, 6 months ago, that you smell the water. It's funky. Residents, I anecdotally tasted it. It tastes like you're being punched in the face. I just, and this is on my Twitter, it's in videos, just interviewed a bunch of residents. They were showing me active rashes, not like scars from 6 years ago. Not to mention, there are residents telling us that when they go in the shower, their eyes burn. So it's not just about lead. There are a lot of other contaminants that were in that water that they never tested for. So that's why it's kind of, this is the kind of danger of corporate media. They have not investigated at all. They have not followed up on this story. That's why we keep going. And then they kind of just lazily just take the testing numbers from the state of Michigan and EPA funded scientists. That's another thing. Most of the independent testers, not just in Flint, but elsewhere, are on grants from the EPA or the states, and their numbers mysteriously show rapid decrease. But in Flint, bottom line, they still 7.5 years later haven't even replaced all the pipes. So how could you say the water's fine if there's still damaged, corroded pipes from acid water in the streets?
You were talking about how the numbers in Flint aren't accurate because they weren't giving accurate numbers. So then in that case, what is the reason that this is being so ignored by not just, Democrats, but also by media?
Well, that's when you get into follow the money. And I'm going to try to simplify this because it's kind of complicated. So remember I told you that this was really a financial fraud that led to this. So essentially, Snyder's administration, along with some county officials in the county that Flint is part of, wanted to push a regional water pipeline, a completely unnecessary regional water pipeline that literally would go along the same exact pathway of the existing Detroit water pipeline that Flint had got its water from for 50 years without an issue. So for this, somebody's got to pay for the construction of this pipeline. So at the time that they were trying to expedite the construction, Flint was basically bankrupt. It had already reached its borrowing limit and could not legally borrow any more money and let to join this pipeline, because Flint would have to borrow money to help with the construction. So the only reason there would be an exception made where they could borrow more money if there was an environmental emergency. So essentially a fake environmental emergency was created, this totally unrelated, like a lime sludge lagoon in the Flint area that needed to be cleaned up. So they created an emergency order for that. And within that emergency order, they snuck in Flint borrowing $100 million to join this pipeline, the KWA pipeline. So it was bond fraud. And the first Flint water investigation, so your audience should know, there was a 3-year investigation under the previous Michigan Attorney General. Current Attorney General Dana Nessel, a Democrat, came in, fired everybody, and started from scratch. The first investigation, they had filed financial charges against two emergency managers that Snyder appointed. Again, Flint was under emergency management. An unelected bureaucrat that Snyder appointed had his power superseded the elected mayor and city council. They were charged, two of them, with false pretenses related to this fraudulent bond deal. Two other officials were also charged with that. Then the new attorney general comes in. She drops all the charges. She recharges those same officials. But incidentally enough, she didn't bring back the financial charges. I've spoken with a lot of people. Why would that be? Well, if financial fraud that led to this bond deal, because Flint was temporarily on the Flint River while this totally unnecessary pipeline was being built, if that advanced in court, you're talking about J.P. Morgan, who underwrote the bonds. You're talking about Wells Fargo, who wrote the bonds. A lot of wealthy investors who own those bonds. They could demand their money back. They could also sue. And who would be on the hook for that, Rania? The state of Michigan, because they approved it. So it's a glaring conflict of interest where the Attorney General's office is prosecuting, people on behalf of the people of Michigan. But on the other end, if they prosecute every crime, specifically financial fraud, it could bankrupt the state of Michigan. So no journalist in Michigan or elsewhere has asked the Attorney General, why did one investigation find financial fraud and we're charging people with it, but your investigation came in nothing? The second thing is, the first investigation, one of our stories broke, they were building a case against Snyder for involuntary manslaughter. This new one charged him in January with a misdemeanor. And our reporting that the first one was going to charge him with involuntary manslaughter, that was backed up by two other Michigan reporters who confirmed it themselves. So, it really, bottom line, if the state of Michigan charges the governor or other top officials with financial fraud, the state of Michigan could potentially go bankrupt, which might be a deterrent to going all the way.
What a it's like a Hollywood crime thriller, this movie. The only thing it's missing is like people getting offed or something, but a lot of people did die. It's just what an insane story. I want to move to another issue that
I just wanted to answer real quick, because you asked you asked about the media. It's not just local media, it's the national media not covering this. Local media, I think there's financial reasons they're not covering it, including money they receive, advertisers, big business basically wanted this swept under the rug, declare it over, because a water crisis is not good for gentrification, which they're trying to gentrify Flint like the rest of America. National media, I mean, I've literally been told from national outlets, is there a connection to Trump? I've literally been told by national media outlets, this happened so long ago and it's kind of assumed that it was a cover up, so we're not really breaking new ground. I said to one editor, wait a minute. So let me get this straight. If President Trump's press secretary, chief of staff, top health officials, let's go down the list. If their phones mysteriously were erased with the phones weren't completely erased, but they have no messages on them from January 2020, February 2020, March 2020, before COVID became a national and global pandemic, you're telling me you wouldn't be apoplectic and this would be the apocalypse? Like, They're just deleting their phones. We don't know who is communicating. We don't know who knew what when. And they were like, well, of course. I'm like, so why is it different for a poor community in Michigan, majority black? I don't care if it was 7 months ago or seven years ago or seven months ago. At the end of the day, they don't give a shit. If it doesn't involve Trump, if it doesn't involve Russia, if it doesn't involve the current horse race, our media doesn't care. And they are, in my view, they are part of the cover up along with the government officials.
Right. Yeah, it would be like getting wall to wall coverage by MSNBC if it had any of the elements that you just mentioned. But of course, it doesn't. And I think another issue that is similar in the way it's treated by the media, and another issue that you and Jen have been covering is on the ground, is this issue of evictions. And, you know, evictions were in the news the last couple weeks because of Cori Bush leading this, what ultimately was a successful sit-in outside of the Capitol Hill to extend the eviction moratorium during the pandemic. And it was nice to see, you know, Joe Biden finally capitulate to the left on something, since, you know, he only ever tries to appease the right. But one thing that was really important about your coverage is that you show that even during this moratorium, people have still been getting evicted. So can you talk a little bit about that and what you saw on your road trips across the country covering this?
Yeah, so there's multiple levels here. Number one, I always tell my audience or people that like say rah-rah to the Democrats, yeah, when federal money is earmarked to go to the states, always look at the fine print. Because we found out, literally, like, it's a scandal. Like, I'd say maybe 5 to 10% of the money that was sent to states to go to pay landlords on behalf of tenants is just sitting there. So they could say, oh, bureaucratic failure. I don't think so. I think a lot of that money is being redirected elsewhere, because ask the people of Flint, for example. $180 million was earmarked from Congress to go towards the Flint water crisis. Go ask the people of Flint how much of that went to them. So when you see federal money going to whether it's evictions, rent relief, whatever, always follow through to see if the money actually goes, because usually it's diverted to donors, nonprofits, real estate, et cetera. So when we were on the road, particularly in Louisville, we learned this federal eviction moratorium that everybody cheered about, which is a good thing if it actually worked, had more loopholes, you know, than a roller coaster. It was only for non-payment of rent. So landlords basically, you know, got them on nuisance violations, just making up nuisance violations, or you're not keeping your property well kept, or your lease is up, so we're just not going to re-sign the lease. So in Louisville, I mean, I was told by the Louisville Eviction Project, because this was a nonprofit that was monitoring and getting the data for evictions. They were in evictions court during the height of the pandemic last year, 20 to 30 people getting evicted every day. I spoke with a woman in Louisville. She worked for the U.S. Census Bureau, laid off because of the pandemic. Should have got unemployment, by the way, didn't get it. And she was evicted by her landlord, not even for non-payment, for the lease being up. And only because of Black Lives Matter Louisville pitched in for an Airbnb for her and other people who were evicted, she would have been homeless otherwise. So, yeah, this was not just in Louisville and other states. People were getting evicted throughout the pandemic, and the media barely covered that or pretended that this moratorium was keeping everybody afloat. It did protect a lot of people. I don't want to say it didn't, but there was a whole lot of other people. We're talking, you know, tens of thousands of people who were evicted during the pandemic because the federal moratorium didn't really have teeth in it. And we also learned, I mean, literally you have real estate developers and nonprofits kind of as a cabal with local city councils trying to gentrify the hell out of, you know, poor parts of Louisville, poor parts of Detroit, force residents out so that they could bulldoze, you know, homes, apartment complexes, and build up, you know, beautiful Whole Foods and strip, you know, entertainment complexes or luxury condos. So we found in Louisville, literally, real estate developers were basically dictating eviction policy to the city council. So it is one dark, corrupt thing. And yeah, I mean, I think what Cori Bush did was great. You know, I know a lot of the left is, you know, it's a photo op. Listen, millions of people would be evicted right now if not for her. So take a friggin' victory. But Yeah, but even before that, people were being evicted.
Yeah, it's actually horrible. And I actually do want to get to some of the interesting reactions from certain segments of the left about that. But before we go there, I mean, there does seem to be this massive disconnect between that's always existed, but it's become more stark during the pandemic. But, you know, between elites and people, and, you know, you even see it like with Obama's big birthday bash, right? Like at Martha's Vineyard and hundreds of people getting together to celebrate and like all these expensive superstars and just like just the most luxurious party that you can imagine while people are dealing with, you know, like the eviction crisis, dealing with dirty water, dealing with, you know, I was in Alabama a few years ago. I did a mini documentary about the sewage crisis in Alabama, where people don't have money to pay for proper sewage system. So the sewage just goes into their yards. And then there's all these kinds of diseases that people end up getting that really you usually only find in like developing countries that have little infrastructure. It's shocking to see some of these diseases in the richest country in the world, because there's no proper sewage systems. Like, it's just these basic things in this very wealthy country, while these people who live on like a different planet, Democrats and Republicans, really not only don't do anything about it, they do these symbolic things that don't even end up helping everybody in the way that they should. And, you know, the reason I say that is because of the Nina Turner campaign, because this is somebody who has some serious progressive bona fides. I mean, she was like on track to become one of these superstar Democrats. And then she came out and endorsed Bernie Sanders in 2016. And she's just become more and more progressive since. And, you know, she supports Medicare for all. She supports ending wars. She supports all of these things, you know, on climate change that we need so much right now, given the sort of like apocalyptic scenarios we're facing, especially with climate change. And then what ended up happening, you had the elites of the Democratic Party, the corporate wing, the wing that actually controls the party, come in and pour millions of dollars into this other person, Chantel Brown, her opponent, and completely sinking her campaign. You covered this campaign. Can you talk about, you know, how that went down? And also, I'd like for you to respond to this. Let's start with this, because, you know, the mainstream kind of takeaway of Nina Turner's loss is that the left wing anti-establishment wing of the party is just not what voters want after Trump. That's the analysis that we're getting from like the New York Times and all these other mainstream outlets. Is that accurate? Would you agree with that? Or is there something else behind her loss?
I think there's a lot of similarities between Bernie's campaign and Nina's campaign. Obviously, Nina's much smaller, a local district. Actually, that's not true that voters don't want what the left has to offer. What is true is there's a mismatch between, you know, hardcore progressives and what they believe about the Democratic Party and what the revolution they want to see, and frankly, the majority of voters who actually agree with us on the policies, but do not agree that the Democratic Party is corrupt, do not, you know, are kind of look at politics in terms of Team Blue and Team Red, and essentially get turned off, not by the policies, but they are susceptible to the brainwashing from the corporate media that these are bad Democrats, they're not loyal, they're going to be too divisive, they don't want to get things done, they just want to make a point. So I think, you know, unfortunately, and people aren't going to like me saying this, and I'll be a sellout, but this is the reality, and I see it on the ground. Progressives need to decide, do we want to spend our time trying to shift the generational thinking of a lot of older voters, a lot of, you know, middle-aged voters, of, you know, we need small victories, we got to take small victories. Democratic Party is far superior to the Republican Party. Do we want to spend our time trying to basically try and convince them the Democratic Party is corrupt? Or do we want to spend our time actually meeting them where they are and intelligently making the case that, you know, it's not that we're trying to, you know, burn the house down, but here are the issues with what the Democratic Party has offered. And that, frankly, the Democratic establishment, they're very well organized. They came in at the exact right time. against Nina Turner, even though Nina Turner in total earned more money than Chantel Brown. In the final weeks, she was badly outspent on TV by all these super PACs and this and that. I mean, you couldn't turn the channel in Cleveland mm-hmm. without an attack ad on Nina Turner, but the left was not as well organized as the establishment. You had people basically suggesting, oh, she's running as a Democrat, I'm out. Or, oh, she didn't go to this rally, Medicare for All rally, even though she's running ads on TV on Medicare for All, and at every event is talking Medicare for All, I'm out. And basically because she wasn't, I got this even after I interviewed her, because she wasn't ranting loud enough against the Democratic Party and Biden in a very pro-Biden, pro-Democratic Party district. She's a sellout, she's going to fold, blah, blah, blah. And these people, this is the problem. The left doesn't seem, its main focus doesn't seem to be on winning anymore. And not everybody, but like this growing portion of the left, it doesn't seem about...
Well, the loudest, I think, like, we're right. talking, so to be specific, we're talking about people who have platforms, right?
Right.
Like the people who get to like set the agenda in terms of like what others see.
But the people following them,
yeah.
there's really more of a shift towards political nihilism and burn it all down rather than let's win some victories. And yes, if Nina Turner folds or doesn't fight, you pressure them, you shame them, and possibly primary them. But there seems to be this built, I mean, I even saw it when I credited Cori Bush, I tweeted mm-hmm. out, you know, all these people who have been complaining that Cori Bush and the squad doesn't fight seem to be silent when mm-hmm. they have fought and won. And the slew of comments like, oh, it's a photo op. Oh, it doesn't stop all evictions. Oh, this and that. It's like, it seems to me there's more focus on anger and nihilism than actual victories and winning.
So, you know, I think that this speaks to a kind of weakness on the left. And I want to be clear here, because I think that like when we talk about the left, we can't point to one cohesive movement. And that's right. the problem, right? That's the problem.
Always been the problem. Always been the problem.
There isn't one cohesive movement. The left is so weak and so fractured. And there's different strains of it that have, I think, legitimate policy disagreements with one another. But there's also just no leadership in it. I mean, I think it's also the aftermath of the collapse of the Bernie Sanders campaign, right? And it happened after 2016 too, though I think it was more dramatic this time around, where it's like Bernie Sanders campaign united everyone and everybody was like, okay, we can all get on board with this. For the most part, everyone, right? Like from different factions of the left. And with that campaign and opportunity for success gone, it's like, everyone is kind of like, doesn't know where to go and who to follow. And, you know, and then also there's, I think, something else taking place, which you've kind of spoken to, but it's the issue of the left media, right? And I don't want to go attack, this is not about attacking anybody. I don't want to attack anyone here. It's more just an observation about, and algorithms have to do with this too. It's what gets fed into people's feeds. It's what gets promoted and prioritized, and it's gossip and it's trashing each other. And it's, you know, you've noticed this too. Like you do a million stories, a million incredible, important, explosive stories on Flint, Michigan, on the evictions, and it's not getting pushed into people's feeds despite the number of followers you have. Meanwhile, if I or someone else were to do a segment about TYT trashes this person, it's like YouTube actually promotes that. Like, so it's not just, I don't want to blame it just on the left media. I think it's also what's being rewarded. And I think this kind of tabloid-esque gossipy stuff is what's being promoted and rewarded in the algorithms. And that's really sad. It's really sad because that isn't what people should be paying attention to, because it's not real. Like TYT fighting or trash talking me. I mean, Anna Kasparian, trash talk me in her show. I don't really care, like whatever, but it's like they trash talk me. That doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any impact on the ground. It doesn't have any impact on organizing. It's just gossip, but that's what gets promoted in the algorithm. I don't know. What do you think about what I just said? I don't know if you agree or disagree or if you have more to add.
Yeah, I'll be a little bit more forward and stern.
Here we go.
first of all, like my feelings on TYT are no secret. So I'm not a fan, but like, I don't need to, not just for like what happened with me personally, but like even when I was there, I thought they were really shifting to lunacy and Trump derangement syndrome. And I said that publicly when I was there. But I think a lot of online viewers, they're kind of being fooled or misled into thinking like taking down TYT is the holy grail. And if we just take down TYT, that will part the sea for things like Medicare for All and this or that. I'm not saying like never criticize TYT or never criticize other certain hosts or me or whatever, or politicians. That's not the thing. But at a certain point, it's very clear this is beyond valid criticism. This is a money-making and growth scheme. You see, I mean, I'll just call them grifters because that's what they are. I mean, you'll see there's this new like conglomerate of like 10 to 15, 15 channels of like, frankly, 20 something dudes who literally do every single video on TYT, Jimmy first TYT, or this one first TYT, or commentary about other people's commentary. And then they pretend like
tweets. They'll do a whole video on tweets.
And then they pretend, well, we're just making the headline kind of a little bit more incentivizing so we could get them through the door for the serious discussion. It's like, get the fuck out of here. You're literally talk like literally as millions of people are being evicted, literally as Flint still doesn't have clean water, literally as fill in the blank, you know, dropping bombs still all over the world. You're literally talking about like what TYT. And I actually think like how this all started or whatever, like, of course, Aaron Maté has a right to defend himself against smears. I had no issue with that. He should go on whatever show he wants. But it really spiraled from that to just kind of like the TMZification of the left. And people are not doing this because they think the most important topic in America at this moment is the Young Turks smearing people. They're doing it for clicks, and they've been rewarded. A lot of these channels have, in my view, taken shortcuts, and they're gaining subscribers and gaining views. And I'll be on the ground interviewing Breonna Taylor's aunts and getting like 300 live viewers, while others live about TYT versus whomever of the day is getting 1,000 live viewers. I don't really feel a jealousy about it. I feel it's a disservice to the left, and because people aren't being informed about what's really going on. And of course, listen, we all like a food fight from time to time, entertainment from time to time. But this has really become, to me, what you're seeing in progressive media is really this kind of really stupid, unproductive, and frankly, self-sabotaging game of like TV show Survivor, like Survivor, who's the last pure, real progressive standing. And it will create clicks and entertainment for the next 5 to 10 years, but it will keep us as perennial losers.
Yeah, no, I think that's the sad part about it. And, you know, I think, again, I think it goes beyond these individuals necessarily. I think there's also something very bad happening in journalism, right? Where journalism is this industry that is collapsing, has been collapsing for the last 10 to 15 years because of the funding model not working anymore. And as a result, you've had just a shedding of like 20,000 journalism jobs in the past couple of years even. And there's so few platforms and places to even start out now, unlike maybe there was 20 years ago, that I think it's actually doing a disservice to people in the sense of like, if you can't go into journalism and make a living, then you're not going to go into journalism. And so, you know, we're not getting people coming into journalism anymore who can do alternative media because they can't make a living. The only way to almost like sustain yourself, and there's exceptions, of course, like your outlet has managed to make it work. I know you guys struggle. My outlet has managed to make it to work, but it's not easy. We know it's not easy, but the model that works is this tabloid entertainment stuff. And that's really bad because it's like, you do see these kind of young 20 somethings coming up and making these sort of like gossipy, you know, TYT, this, that, because they're being rewarded by the algorithm. This is how they're making money. This is how they're able to make a livelihood. I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying it's almost like being in alternative media has become less about journalism and more about if you can entertain people.
Right.
But the problem there, go ahead.
I think that's true, but it's also not true in some ways. So just a quick story. When I, before we started Status Quo, I actually met with a couple people I knew in New York, kind of who were in corporate media, because I for a dark time in my life, worked at Fox News. Then I worked at MSNBC.
I didn't know that. You were in the mainstream. I didn't know that.
I could do a whole live stream on that. out of college, I really wasn't even that politically knowledgeable. So I just thought Fox was like a news channel. I'm like, oh, I got a job. I quickly learned that was not the case. And then I went to MSNBC and I left after a year because I was just done with corporate bullshit. But people that I spoke with before Status Quo, when I told them what I wanted to do, the Flint stories, environmental protests, you know, et cetera, they were like, kind of like, oh, that's really nice that you want to cover real stuff, but that will never, you know, that will never sell. People don't want care about that stuff. And I knew they were wrong because I had already, through TYT, like grown a channel very fast off of not just Bernie's election, but other things like Flint, Standing Rock. And I know for a fact, I didn't need like market research that there's a huge hunger for this.
Right.
I personally had the kind of head start, I guess, because, you know, I was able to grow a following on TYT. So then when I launched my own outlet, Jen and I launched it together. At least I had that foundation where people knew who I was, even though we were being buried in YouTube's algorithm. At least we were able to bring in some audience to start. And then through actual journalism, yeah, we do commentary, but like our bread and butter is going out there. We were right. able to build a paid subscriber model. So we're close to 2,000. And we started that in 2019. So it doesn't, like, we don't have to worry as much about, clickbaity bullshit headlines. And, you know, if we really wanted to make money, trust me, we would have been covering Trump and Russia for the last 5 years. But for these people who are just doing this TMZ food fight, if they wanted to, like, not everybody has to be like an in-the-field reporter. It's not for everyone. But if they wanted to do, you know, commentary or analysis or some reporting on things that other people aren't covering, they could build a model because more and more people are understanding, yeah, we're going to have to fund this kind of journalism if we want real journalism.
Yeah.
That's what we've done. So we don't, like the Flint videos and things like that, they don't go viral. They don't get a million views, but it helps us convert free viewers to paid members because who the hell else is doing it? So I think for all these people, like essentially, I think grifting, you'd be surprised. It's like, do not try and live or die from YouTube clicks and views, because go ask TYT how that worked. Their whole business model was YouTube and they're sinking like the Titanic.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I might be being too generous or you're being too pessimistic. Usually I'm the one being too pessimistic, but I don't usually get that. So I appreciate though that like we have the back and forth about it. I also guess I would like to think like when I was coming up, when I was in my early 20s and I was, starting to learn about the left and leftism, and you know, I had outlets like Democracy Now. I was really like that really was a gateway for me. And it's actually one of the reasons I wanted to go into independent media. There were some other outlets too, but that one really stands out the most, even though I'm pretty disappointed in the kind of turn they've taken in some ways, but it happens. They've kind of moved into more of a liberal sphere. But, you know, I feel like when I see younger people now, like, what are they looking up to? And if all they have that they see is that TYT model, then that's what they're going to replicate, right? And so, like, maybe that's why I'm being a little too generous about it, because I feel like I had a lot of outlets that were big and that were in my face in alternative media, to be fair, that I could like look to, and a lot of journalists I can look to. And now it's just, it doesn't seem that way. Again, maybe I'm being too generous, but I don't want to spend too much time on this topic. I do think it was just important to like talk about, because I feel like your viewpoint has really been missing from this entire discussion, where it's just been kind of like, who's the loudest and making the most videos about it.
I mean, real quick, Rania, the bottom line is, I mean, in conversations we've had to try and get actual funding, we were offered like a lot of funding, big money from a certain plutocrat Democrat. We turned it down. We turned it down because honestly, I don't really give a shit what guarantees were given. You know, this person's track record, out of respect, I'm not going to say who, but this person's track record, we didn't want to be involved. But the reality is, like, I have said to people that we've tried to get funding through, mostly like viewers or actual progressive individuals, we literally don't have any competition. Like, I don't mean that condescendingly, excuse me, arrogantly, we go places and there's no other media covering these stories. Flint, literally the local media and Detroit and Flint, they don't cover it anymore. So it's like, if you have, and this is to journalists who might want to be covering up, I even tell people who ask me, what would be your advice now? I say, go to city council meetings where you live. You could do it with your phone. I guarantee you, you will not see many journalists there, and start digging, building sources, not through politicians, but through the residents and activists. You'll find out the truth from them. And don't worry at first about how many people are watching. It doesn't matter if it's your mom and your dog. Worry about covering it, building sources, because at some point you're going to cover something or find out information that picks up or break it. And all of a sudden an outlet like Status Quo or Breaking Points or whatever will share it. And you're off to the races. So,
So, being that person, no, that's actually a really good point, because, you know, doing what other people aren't doing, especially important work, is really what matters, especially in the long run. And it is, I mean, just being there, I know from experience, I mean, just being in the Middle East makes a difference for, you know what I mean? Just being on the ground, talking to people who are being evicted makes a difference. Being, in your case, Standing Rock, you know, made a huge difference. I do want to move to a topic that I think, I don't know actually if we agree on this or not. I'm curious. If we don't, it'll be a little bit more exciting. But, you know, I'm curious what your opinion is about the Democratic Party. I go back and forth on this because, you know, whenever it's like during a presidential election, angry people who are angry at me about this, but I was like, I voted for Joe Biden because I really didn't want Trump to be president again. I think Trump being president was very bad for the country. Obviously, I despise the Democratic Party and what it stands for, but I thought this would be less bad for the world. So I played into that lesser evil kind of thing. But aside from presidential elections, like, I really don't believe people should be, I'm not saying it's wrong to, and if you're going to do it, fine, but I don't think the focus should be changing the Democratic Party, because I don't think it's ever going to happen. Like, people have been trying to do it for the last 40 years, and the party has only become more right-wing. Like, I think the focus should be on building outside of the Democratic Party organizations, parties, whatever, that can then pressure that party and actually do things like strikes and protests and whatever it is that can actually like force power to concede, at least, or, you know, some things. When it comes to third parties, I don't think they're a bad thing. I don't think they're going to win. They're not going to win presidential elections. You just can't, a two-party like duopoly like we have. But I don't think it's bad they exist. And I don't think they should get blamed for like Democrats losing. But I guess my question for you, having covered so much of like the sort of progressive side of Democratic politics and, you know, the squad and being around Nina Turner's campaign, like, what do you think is the right answer to this? Do you think people should continue like running inside the Democratic Party with the intention to change it? Do you think people should be building outside of the Democratic Party? Do you think third parties are a bad idea or a good idea? Like, where do you stand on that stuff?
I have a kind of a multi-pronged approach. I don't think it's any one thing. And I've been called a sellout and, you know, whatever, a sheepdog for the Democratic Party. So first of all, to me, people are looking at it through what the letter is next to the politician as the most important. I mean, the Democratic Party is corrupt. I've been saying it and reporting it for years. But not realizing Joe Biden isn't really the one making the decisions. None of these. Pelosi is not making the decisions. Maybe on foreign policy, to it, they are. The donors dictate the line that the politicians can go up to. Why do you think it is that we're the only major country that literally, like, didn't backstop people's pay during the pandemic? Didn't, you know, we're really the only country that, like, put millions of people on unemployment rather than just directly UBI or paying, you know, Europe paid people the payrolls. They covered the payrolls, the government. So, like, focusing as much on whether it's the Democratic Party politicians, the Republican Party politicians, whatever, you're forgetting that this system, this corrupt government we have, did not happen overnight. And I think a lot of people kind of got caught up in the Bernie wave and the sentiment of revolution, thinking just one politician or one group of politicians can topple this corrupt system that's developed over 40 to 50 years. You have to focus electorally, but even more importantly, outside, because I've been covering protests now for 6-7 years. I don't want to diminish Black Lives Matter. I don't want to diminish Sunrise Movement. I don't want to diminish any of these groups. Protest is great. They'll let you protest. They'll try to crack your heads in at certain ones. But who are these groups are organizing economic protests? That's the fastest way to change, Rania. And slowly but surely, we're seeing these these workers starting to strike Alabama, Kansas, South Dakota. Amazon workers are organizing in New York and having some success. Like, if you threaten the donors' wallets, because the donors control the politicians, the donors, they are not willing to have a quarterly profit dip, dip.
Yeah.
So if you pressure the donors, I'm talking Amazon, Walmart, fast food, big banks, you name it. If you start pressuring that, they tell the politicians, you got to give them something. Yeah. And that's how change throughout history, by the way, they killed Martin Luther King, not because he wanted civil rights, when he started talking about jobs, poverty, and socialism. That's what he got killed. So my whole point is, don't get me wrong, like, I'm not against third parties, but I'm for winning. You need to seize power, not have I don't want to call it a vanity project, but like MPP or these third parties, it would take a very long time. Just because it would be righteous and morally and values based, more in sync with progressives, doesn't mean it's going to, in a wave, start electing Congress people or senators or presidents. It doesn't mean don't work on it. But like, people have this black or white zero sum game thing. Like, we're done with the Democratic Party. We're going to focus on third party or just outside boycotts and stuff. When the reality is, focus on the individual. I'll use Nina Turner as an example. Okay. First of all, there was no option for her to run as MPP Green Party in Ohio. Green Party lost ballot access. MPP don't have it. The state makes it very difficult to run as an independent. It's not a guarantee that you could run as an independent. You have to like prove that you're have no connection to both parties. So she ran as a Democrat. People just forgot her track record because she wasn't ranting on the campaign trail like she did on the Bernie campaign trail.
Yeah.
So they forgot this person, Democrat or not, literally in 2015 committed what was then political suicide, deserting the Clintons and going to Bernie. She did that when Bernie was not surging or the campaign was exploding. She did it when he was an underdog. In 2016, when she raised hell at the DNC on behalf of Bernie delegates.
I remember that.
In 2020, when she literally basically moved to South Carolina working to try and get him elected. So people just forgot about that because some YouTube host said, oh, she's selling out, she's running as a Democrat, blah, 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 blah. And that's why I meant the establishment got organized. They got in right on time, huge money, huge media attacks, where the left, because she wasn't ranting and raving loud enough for them, basically did not organize for her. So my point is, to me, it doesn't matter if they run as a Democrat, MPP, a marshmallow. I don't give a shit. I care about the individual. People didn't seem to have a major issue with Bernie running as a Democrat two times. They got on board. So, you know, there have been good Democrats throughout history. Henry Wallace, who should have been vice president and would have been president if not for the Democratic Party screwing him in the 1940s to get FDR to remove him as vice president.
Sounds so familiar.
FDR, obviously. Not a lot, but few. So my point is, people, this isn't about propping up the Democratic Party. The way you get Medicare for all, the way you get a Green New Deal, ending fracking, cutting the military budget, you need to get more victories. Yes, I think the squad is folded like a cheap tent. I've criticized them. I'm happy to see they have some pulse now. But at the end of the day, don't project onto other people like Nina Turner your anger and frustration with this group of politicians. Because if you're just going to declare they're all frauds, they're all sellouts, they're all going to fold, then why the fuck are you even paying attention? Go put on
so I think,
Go put on 90 Day Fiance and call it a day.
I don't think you're wrong about that, but I think there's two ends of this too. There's also the other end of it where it's like the squad can do no wrong, and anybody who makes a light critique of their policy choices or of any individual that maybe voted for something that they're not unhappy they voted for, is like, you know, an evil misogynist who just like hates women. Like there's also that end of it too. So I don't want to like, pretend like that doesn't exist. And that's what I mean is, I do think you're right though. I think the multi-pronged approach is what makes the most sense, is like having people everywhere.
But also like what I meant by zero sum game, I agree with you. I mean, I've criticized the squad.
I know you have.
In certain corners, that's blasphemy. But this zero sum, all or nothing thinking is like, all right, so they didn't force the vote. They did magazine covers with Nancy Pelosi, call a mama bear, blah, blah, blah. So we're canceling them, period. Mm. A couple months later, Cori Bush does fight. The squad rallied around her. They get a victory. Is it a full blanket of canceling rent? No. We don't have the White House, folks. We don't have majorities in Congress and Senate. Bernie can't wave a wand. These people can't wave a wand. The most they can do is block legislation and play hardball. So I was pointing out to people online, okay, well, they're starting to play hardball. It's not just them, by the way. This, you know, the same people criticizing Bernie for months, and I've criticized Bernie. This $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, the only reason it's happening is because of Bernie Sanders, because he played hardball. And he said, I'm not voting for this bipartisan bill. Democrats can't afford to lose any votes on the Democratic side. I will not vote for this if we don't have a $6 trillion reconciliation bill. He knew he wasn't getting $6 trillion, but he did the intelligent thing, unlike Obama and these other idiots. He didn't give away the farm right out of the negotiation. So that's why you have $3.5 trillion. Is it Medicare for all? No. Is it the largest social spending package in the modern American history? Yes. That's because Bernie fought. Now you have squad members saying, we're not going to vote for this bipartisan deal that just passed in the Senate. It's not for that. So they're starting to play hardball, but then you get people saying like, oh, it's talk, this and that. Make up your mind, people. You can't just blanket declare everybody a fraud, sellout, and you're done with them. If they are starting to do what you want, you know what gives them more leverage? Why was Cori Bush successful? Because people started coming out on the Capitol steps with her, because people started pushing it on digital. That helps give the politicians leverage. Don't bow down to them, but don't just universally declare people frauds and sellouts and then not support them when they are fighting for the things you say you want them to fight for.
And I think you're right in that. I think, you know, of course, you know, call them out when they don't do what you want and stuff like that. But at the same time, like, you also have to remember that these people do have millions of followers who like adore them and support them because they believe that they're progressives. And it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier, where if you want to organize people, you don't want to alienate those people who actually agree with you on almost everything in terms of policy by just constantly trashing the people that they admire and support, as much as good as that might feel, right? As good as it might feel to just be like, here's what I can't stand about AOC. And there's a lot, you know, about policy wise that I don't like about her.
She's terrible.
That said, she has lots of supporters who actually probably agree with me on a lot of things. And so I don't want to like waste my time alienating people who support her just to like, you know, get a bash in. It's just, you know, ultimately not the most productive way to go about reaching people who might actually agree with you on a lot.
I also think that it's important to say, and I would assume you agree, what I'm saying is not recognizing the people that are declaring everybody frauds, sellouts, cowards, just black or white, I'm done with them. I understand your frustration, because I feel the frustration. Trust me, I'm on the road seeing the misery and corruption up close. I feel it just as much.
I'm in the Middle East. I'm like, what? Like it's all around me in like the most miserable way. I totally feel you on that front. So
you're right to be angry. You're right to be cynical. You're right to be frustrated. Hell, you're right to feel rage. Anger can be a good thing if weaponized correctly. Because I'm sorry to tell you, we're not going to rant and rave our way to Medicare for all. That's just not how change works. Martin Luther King didn't, you know, scream Lyndon B. Johnson is a coward and fraud. Okay, he created an army and he applied pressure at the right moment. I was forced to vote, but I said publicly, I'm for it. but you're self-sabotaging yourself by you're trying to convince this politician, these politicians to do something, yet you're calling them Lucifer. That's just human psychology. That doesn't work. So you will give them an opportunity to discredit
like,
maybe you.
Not, see, now I'm like, this is where I go back and forth because I agree with what you're saying, but then I'm also like, it is good to have figures that push the margins. Like it is
pushing
good to have your
Malcolm X,
right? It is good to have your Black Panthers who would be the ones who would say like the kind of like screw them all, they're all devils. But it's kind of like, it creates more space for you, actually. So there's a balance, right? We need like a balance. We need a balance that's productive, but we don't have that.
The truth is, and I, you know, this is where I kind of disagree with like people like Jimmy and others who I agree with them on policy. I think Jimmy and others think like this is the way to make them fear you. And if we scream like this and we threaten them, not physically, obviously, just politically. If we just scream loud enough, rant loud enough, shame them enough, they fear us. It's the opposite. you're giving them a layup to discredit you. I get what you're saying, Malcolm X and all those things, obviously. But like, what did AOC do? And I said this during Force the Vote. I said, she is going to turn around and say, I'm not doing it because, and point to the venom against her. And she turned around and she said, this is violence. Obviously, that was bullshit. But and it, you know, honestly, yeah, Jimmy Dore is not the thing. It's not, and I've seen this starting after Bernie endorsed Hillary in 2016. This sentiment coming out of understandable anger, but like let's burn down the house, and it doesn't matter who the hell is in the house still, because at the end of the day, I think Force the Vote, for example, would have been a lot more successful if there were pressure campaigns outside their offices, if there were pressure campaigns online, not the fraud squad, but like, where's, I don't know, I'm not good with hashtags. AOC, where's the ruckus? Like shaming them.
Oh my God, I'm really not good with hashtags. Yeah. That was terrible. Where's the ruckus?
shaming them strategically to the point where it can't be said that you're, divisive scumbags, whatever. People call that tone policing. No, I'm telling you, that is more successful. Like Cori Bush, for example, when she was on the Capitol steps, she was criticizing Biden and the Democratic Party. She was not calling them, vicious names, things like that. People could say what they want. I'm not talking about tone policing. I'm talking about strategic messaging, strategic strategy to actually move things. And I think that's what people are forgetting. They think what makes them cheer on YouTube is the same thing as what will force politicians to do something. And that's not the same thing.
And so I guess going back to like the real stuff, because again, I also think there's just such a disconnect between what's happening on the ground, like in real life, and then what's happening on, our YouTube shows. There's such a huge disconnect. And I really feel that. I know you feel it being on the ground, talking to people. I'm in the Middle East. And so like when I see people using the middle, like talking about Syria in like this weird weaponized way where Syria like literally just became about them. And I'm like, but Syria is not like no one in Syria even knows who you are. Like just this massive disconnect. Like, I guess like what is, if we're speaking to those people right now, like what should they be paying attention to? Like, what are the kinds of stories you're covering? Flint, you're covering the evictions. What else is happening on the ground across America that you're seeing that isn't getting the coverage that it needs and that people need to be paying attention to?
Right. Well, first of all, I don't think I think people look at our coverage of Flint and they like it, but they also think like, why are you so focused on this particular story? And to me, this is the number one story in the country because it's not just about Flint. Frankly, it's the number one story in the world to me. And I'll tell you why, because water privatization is happening everywhere, okay? And by the way, why do you think hedge funders have the most rapidly moving investment is water over the last few years? Why do you think that is? Because they intelligently realize there's probably going to be a shortage of clean water, and that is what the next world war might be fought. Not oil, water. So to me, the bottom line is, if American citizens and Frank, also a lot of undocumented people there, if they are poisoned, okay, intentionally or unintentionally, And then there is a cover-up of that poisoning. Both parties don't do anything to help them and basically leave them to slowly die. If that is not continued to be, if there is not continued coverage of that, if there is not continued investigation of that, if there is not accountability, real accountability, not a misdemeanor, you think it's not coming to a town near you? I mean, yeah. It might not be water. It might be fracking. It might be mining. It might be fill in the blank of environmental genocide. But if there's no accountability over here, what makes you think your governor or mayor or city council people or plutocrats spying off the politicians aren't going to cut corners where you live or aren't going to try to make profit at the expense of safety? So that's why we cover it. And the other thing is, because I go on the ground, at the end of the day, I'm still interviewing people who have rashes now, who have health problems now. This isn't some distant thing. So to me, they should be covering Flint. To me, the other major story is, you know, I think a lot of people look at, the evictions and exploding homelessness and this and that. But there's very little coverage of the local corruption in local governments. All the focus is on the horse race nationally. I mean, corruption is everywhere, states, cities, local municipalities. But as we talked about, that probably wouldn't be sexy for YouTube's algorithm or whatever. So people kind of don't focus on it. But honestly, yes, you're being screwed nationally. You're being screwed most of all locally because there is no coverage of local issues, in part because of what you said, media being basically decimated. And the third thing I'll say is, I mean, you want to talk about the climate crisis and what that new report that came out that basically says like this is essentially irreversible at this point. Well, Gavin Newsom is handing out fracking permits like candy. Cuomo, before he resigned in disgrace, same thing. Biden, he ran on, blocking or forbidding drilling on public land. Oh, that isn't happening. So literally part of why the climate catastrophe is happening, a major part, is fracking. And the Democratic Party is continuing to allow it. That is a top story, a major issue. Go look in Minnesota right now. That's a crude oil pipeline, not natural gas, but same shit, different day. All of this is pouring accelerant onto the already existing inferno. There's some coverage of it, but that's the Democratic Party currently handing it out on the federal level and the state level governors. So we know Republicans love it, but to me, that's the top issue because like if there's no planet Earth, we can't rant on YouTube.
Right. That's a good point. If there's no planet Earth, we can't rant on YouTube. That should be like a bumper sticker. Jordan, thank you so much for giving me so much of your time. I really appreciate it. Before we say bye here, where can people follow your work and where can they follow Status Quo?
You could follow us youtube.com/status quo. We are on YouTube, so make sure you're subscribed or subscribe. youtube.com/status quo, Twitter @status quo. And actual journalism is not cheap. So if you want to support us, statusquo.com/join, $5 a month. You get also bonus content and all that. Statusquo.com/join.